This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 15th of August 2015 on Monocle 24.
From boardroom shuffles at the Economist Group to the best of the newsstands of Switzerland, via some of the best travel titles around. Throw in a great new independent from Argentina, and you have this week's summer sun-kissed edition of The Stack. On the programme this week, our editor-in-chief gives us his views on Pearson selling its 50% stake in the Economist Group and shares his magazine choices on the Swiss newsstands. We'll also be chatting with Serena Genn, editor of Suitcase magazine, about her favourite travel magazines.
The National Geographic, like classical National Geographic, is the kind of pinnacle of travel magazines for a lot of people. It makes it relevant and kind of accessible to them.
Then we hear from Juan Ignacio Moralejo, editor of a brand new independent Argentinian magazine, Compost.
I wanted to do a kind of magazine that was not just for, you know, younger generation. And, you know, it actually happened.
All that and more besides coming up for you today on The Stack, Monocle's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. You are listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Time to check in with our editor-in-chief. Today we find him in Switzerland. Good morning to you, Tyler. Tell us, paint a picture of where you are this week.
Paint a picture, Tom. If I had to paint a picture, I would say it's not unlike our cover, which hopefully you will have seen. The September issue is in the office. It might be in the very hot hands of the odd person around Europe who, of course, might have special access to our printer or special supply. Our cover features the Slovenian families, and the Slovenian families are they sound like a Germanic invention, Tom. They're, in fact, a Japanese invention. But there are these very cute, cozy critters who, you know, you have hedgehogs and you have chipmunks, and they all live in a very sort of perfect little idyllic Sylvanian village. And that's kind of where I am in Switzerland at the moment. I'm in Samaritz, the sun is shining, and it's a glorious late August day.
Perfect. Well, I hope there aren't too many woodland creatures in and amongst it right now, because we want to get your view on a few of the big media stories of the week. And I guess, Tyler, it's interesting to check in again. We talked about the destiny of the Financial Times in recent weeks and more moves from that, its former stable, of course, Pearson selling up a half of The Economist. And we've talked about this. But, I mean, what are your thoughts as the kind of dust settles on that deal about what that might mean?
Well, I think with a little bit of hindsight at this point, it's amazing. And I don't think too many people have spent much time. Of course, there was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to this. Oh, you know, seeing, you know, a big Asian company, of course, you know, coming into London and taking over the FT. But it is remarkable to look at this real shakeup now. Pearson, you know, has released this major newspaper, their 50% interest in one of the world's most respected news weeklies. And of course, you know, one topic that we touched on as well is now, of course, significant Italian ownership as well. So I think this is just exciting. I think in many ways it also just, you know, underlines, I think, the international position of London. And I'm curious to see how international potentially those newsrooms become, because oftentimes people think of those titles as being well and truly global. But I think we do know when you venture onto the editorial floors, they're still pretty quite English operations.
And it is interesting there, Tyler, you've alluded to it, this Italian ownership. We've got the Agnelli's, the family investment vehicle, which has a number of media interests, actually, not too far away from where you are. Interesting to speculate about what the Nikkei Group ownership could mean for the FT. What might the Agnelli involvement, do you think, mean for The Economist? Obviously, there's a lot of interesting governance issues within The Economist that mean editorial independence and so on is safeguarded. What's your reading of it?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a bit of a bigger push. I think oftentimes particularly these Italian families, they want to, of course, show off their latest trophy. And even from an FT perspective, even though, of course, you know, these two brands are uncoupled, and you have to also admit there wasn't much crossover. You know, the FT and The Economist were kept very, very separate under the Pearson umbrella. But what we have seen over the past year is we've seen the How to Spend It franchise of the Financial Times. It does exist now as a supplement in Italy. So I'm wondering if you might see some moves made either by The Economist Intelligence Unit, you know, or the main magazine, perhaps doing something in terms of a summary edition or some type of spin-off in Italy.
And Tyler, it's just interesting, I guess, that a lot of people will talk about, oh, look, you know, it's obviously buying season for media brands. There's quite a specific reasons behind Pearson's decision to divest itself of these titles. Should we be looking for, you know, what might be next? Or do you think this is very much a sort of a self-contained bit of business driven by Pearson's other concerns?
I think, you know, it's closed with Pearson now. I think that there's really nothing else to probably put on the sales shelf right now, because you know, now they have their core educational, let's say, franchise. You know, that is all there. It's intact. They're rid of pretty much everything else. But what I think this does raise is, we saw a lot of suitors circling the Financial Times, and we have to remember that, you know, Axel Springer out of Berlin has a huge war chest. You know, we know they must have something in the region of probably €1 billion to spend on something. So I think they're certainly hurting. And I think also just the Springer move, I think also, you know, it really sort of forced a lot of other German publishers to really snap to attention. And of course, we know there's a lot of deep-pocketed groups right there. And in many ways, you know, the Germans, not all of them, but some of those publishing groups are in the same situation as the Japanese, like Nikkei. They know they have to go international. On the other side, we saw Thomson Reuters. You know, Thomson Reuters, of course, was in the bidding for the Financial Times. So are they sort of looking at something else as well? We know Bloomberg is sitting out there. So Pearson, I think, you know, that deal is done, but I don't think in terms of new acquisitions, you know, consolidation, etc., I think we could have a very busy autumn. And you have to remember, you know, we're heading towards the last quarter, and that means, you know, if companies have a lot of cash sitting on their books, they're going to be looking to spend.
And Tyler, just a final thought, you're going to be on the road again later today. Before you make your moves, will you have a chance to stop by any of those charming Swiss newsstands? And if you do, what might you be casting an eye over?
Well, you know those newsstands very well, Tom. And of course, there's a fantastic branch of kiosk in the heart of Samaritz. And you know, one of the problems when you go over one of the main sort of mountain passes and you go down into northern Italy, as great as it is, and we always talk about the Italian edicola, and listen, we all know that we love Südtirol, but there's a bit of a magazine cartel there, Tom, which is a problem, and they don't get too experimental with their titles. So that means I really do have to stock up in Samaritz. I'm looking forward. I already spotted it yesterday. I was at the grocery store, the new September edition of German Architectural Digest. It's out. I'm in the midst of decorating a house. What more could I want? So I think that's all the purchase I need today.
Perfect. Well, happy reading to you, Tyler, and happy travels too. We'll catch up again very soon. That's Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, on the line from Switzerland. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Time now to talk travel. For that, I spoke with Serena Genn, editor of Suitcase magazine, who selected some nice travel titles, ideal reading for the summer months. Serena founded Suitcase while in her third year at New York University and won the 2014 Woman of the Future Award for Media. I started off by asking her what her objectives were when she started the magazine way back in her third year at New York University.
When I was first starting Suitcase, I wasn't necessarily thinking about it in terms of success. I was thinking about it as a product that the world really needed at that time. I could see the world was traveling more and more, but people just didn't quite have the right tools to be able to do that. It's kind of like scuba diving with a metal helmet and a rubber tube. You can do it, but there's a lot better technology and a lot better things you can do it with. So it wasn't until I was living in Paris, I was studying abroad, and I really needed a travel source that I could rely on. And I just still couldn't find one. So I basically started putting together my own, and it kind of grew organically from there, because I started sharing that guide with some of my friends, and I started creating other guides, which would just give a different insight into these cities that I knew so well.
Sure. And tell me a little bit more about that process then. Was it a question of not borrowing, but looking at the options, the titles and things that were out there, and saying, well, I kind of like how they do this, but it could be more like this, which would work for me? Or was it a purely creative process? Did you sort of start with the quintessential blank page? What was that sort of creative process like?
Well, I've never had really any experience publishing before, so I don't think I was doing anything in a traditional sense. Yeah. I did a lot of research, so I read basically every single travel magazine that was out there, and maybe half the travel websites. But I just found that the content was basically the same in all of them, or a lot of them. And that was the really worrying thing. And none of them were really practical in any way. Like, obviously, some of them were inspirational, aspirational, but there wasn't this actual getting down to it. Okay, I'm in the city. What do I go and do?
Now, Serena, well, you have got lots of delightful looking magazines. We've got a sort of a summary, you know, tourism feel to things. Where do you want to start? Talk us through a couple of the ones you've got. You've got Big and Small, Thick and Thin. Where should we start?
Can we start with something that's not very summary?
Why not?
It's actually the opposite of summer.
Ruin my cue. That's quite all right. Where do you want to kick off?
I think that people are going on summer holidays in the winter and winter holidays in the summer. So it's all changing around anyway.
That is true. You're quite right.
No, I wanted to actually mention, when you were talking about contributors and this kind of network in the travel industry, I was reading the foreword of this magazine called Sidetracked by the photography director called Martin Hartley. And he's talking about Camp Barneo in the North Pole, which I went to last year as well in March. And
very, very traditional vacation spot.
I was reading the description, and I suddenly realized that I was there exactly the same time as him.
Oh, right.
And I met him, but I had no idea who he was. And it's just a funny coincidence.
I wonder, does his experience as reflected in these pages or in the written word tally with your own? Or
it sounded a little bit more dramatic, his description, than maybe what it was actually like. But it was an incredible experience.
I'm sure. And tell us a little bit more then about this mag. Bigger format than a suitcase. Sort of describe it. Paint the old picture with words of how it would look for our listeners.
So Sidetracked, I'd say, is more about, they call themselves adventurous inspired. And it's all matte. Yeah, it's larger format. And the photography is really, I think, its strong point. Mm. But its focus isn't necessarily on the practical side of travel. It's more on the inspirational, aspirational, remote locations. So they've got everything from a photographer's diary of Afghanistan's Wakhan Corridor by mountain bike.
Amazing pictures, yeah.
Which is not something I'm going to be attempting anytime soon. But it's a really good armchair travel to Jimmy Nelson's pictures of some of the most amazing and tribes in some of the most remote areas of the world again.
Now, you mentioned In Clover. Should we have a look at that one next? This is another, again, a slightly different dimensions. Quite hefty, isn't it? what is it about In Clover that you, I don't know, like or dislike? You can dislike things if you want.
But... Okay. This is, I'm hesitant to call it a slightly more hipster travel magazine, but I think why I like it so much is it shows how people's priorities and mindsets are shifting in their day-to-day life and their travel habits. So a couple of the articles in this issue are basically about how people were living in these hectic cities like London, and one day they decided they actually had enough and they're going to go and live their dream. So one couple moved to Cornwall, and it's about how much happier they are living there. And then one couple just basically set off across the world and lives in a van.
So it kind of takes it away from being about travel as a part-time occupation to people who actually, well, in that sense, a kind of lifestyle title in a different way than it's
Exactly.
used in magazine publishing.
And then there's a whole section on offline getaways, which is a regular feature also in In Clover. And I'm seeing it also from our readers. There's this huge demand for people to go somewhere with absolutely no signal and to completely switch off. I don't know what people think they're going to do when they get there, but it's a really nice romantic concept.
I'm always a big fan of the idea of going and switching off, but then the practicalities seem to often unwind somewhat.
I know. I recently went to Tulum, which is also featured in Traveller here in National Geographic.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about this, because again, this is coming from, I guess, a different sort of place on the the travel mag spectrum. Really, tell us what's your sort of general feeling about this one.
So I feel like the National Geographic, like classical National Geographic, is the kind of pinnacle of travel magazines for a lot of people who you wouldn't think would be interested in that kind of photography. It makes it relevant and kind of accessible to them.
Well, there's something about that kind of traditional yellow framed cover that, well, what's interesting is from all different sort of walks of magazine life that we talked to on the stack, the number of people who reference the National Geographic as being, you know, a sort of seminal part of their magazine education is pretty extraordinary. And I wonder what you think about how the sort of offshoot titles like this, The Traveller, how they sort of fit into the stable. Do you think it's a good addition to that sort of Nat Geo roster?
I like looking through it from time to time. I prefer it to other more traditional commercial travel magazines. Mainly, it's been around for so long, so kind of knows what people want a lot. Mm. But it's a really good gauge of what the majority of people are interested in or are doing at this point in time now. So, I mean, they're featuring cities like Amsterdam and Berlin. but then they'll kind of go out there and feature something like Rwanda here.
Well, I was going to say, it's quite interesting because if you look at it, do you think there's a bit of a different dynamic between the sort of more, as you say, not so popular, but commercial travel titles, and maybe those perhaps like Suitcase that are slightly more considered, it's a bit different, it's not exactly, you know, following the masses, it is slightly more off the beaten track. Are you mindful of setting Suitcase apart from some of those more commercially minded ones? Is that a constant consideration?
Definitely. I think Suitcase is a nice bridge between something like National Geographic Traveller and Inclover. What I think is great about the three magazines that I've picked is they all seem to have like a cult audience. So I want Suitcase to be not as hipster and niche almost as something like Kinfolk, which is a lifestyle title, or Inclover that wouldn't appeal to someone who's not necessarily living in like a metropolitan city or capital. But I still want to have that aspirational aspect.
That was Serene again, editor of Suitcase magazine, talking to me a little earlier.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You're with The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Time now to head to Argentina. Here at Monocle's HQ, we received a rather lovely and almost encyclopedic title recently called Compost, edited by Juan Ignacio Morelejo, based in Buenos Aires. It features stories ranging from Morrissey's letters to musical publications pre-fame to how one lives in a traditional Japanese house. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Juan to ask him about the concept behind Compost.
It's a kind of unpredictable, the magazine, the theme, so after a while I was doing compost at my own apartment and one day it just kind of popped into my mind. Like, I like the idea that compost is also like the translations, like different components of stuff going together, and to me magazines, the ones that I like, are usually that kind of different things together. So, and also I like the name, that it was short and that it could be understood in Spanish and English and kind of everywhere.
And the magazine does surprise you. I mean, you're talking about in terms of the stories, this kind of mixture, because suddenly you have a story about Morrissey letters before he was famous to this music publications. And then you have a lovely article about how to live in a traditional Japanese house.
I think it's because I grew up with all these like general interest magazines like Reader's Digest and Connoisseur. And they're usually like family magazines, like they're shared by my parents, my brothers, and they're usually lying around on the table. So I wanted to do a kind of magazine that was not just for, you know, younger generation. And, you know, it actually happened. Like, I have a contributor, she's in her late 60s, and she wrote an article. She's a psychologist, and she told me the other day that her grandsons were surprised when, because they liked the magazine and they were surprised when they found her writing. So I like that the kids say, okay, there's pictures of snowboarders, but there's also my grandmother speaking about love on some pages. So I like to make that kind of mixture, that everything is connected and life can be interesting, not just being cool or anything like that.
Did you work in other magazines before? What's your background?
Yes, I worked on other magazines. I'm from Buenos Aires, but I started contributing on ID. I think it was around 2004 or 5, when Terry and Tricia Jones came over here to do a workshop, and we got along really well. And then I started to work too for Apartamento. The Omar and Nacho, they sent me the PDF for the idea of issue 1, because I was actually doing my own little magazine called Sede, so they liked that, Marco Velarde. So yeah, I started contributing to them and it's been great doing some houses and people from over here. Yeah, I think those are like the two international ones that I contributed, and then other magazines from over here.
I also want to ask you about the business model. I mean, you do have some ads like at the back of the magazine, but is it more kind of the cover price? I just want to know a little bit more about your business model.
I think the business is actually, you know, the first issue is usually, it was difficult to pitch it to sponsors and investors. So you definitely first one, you have to put some of your own money, even though we had some support from sponsors. So now that we have one issue, we're in talks with investors or even sponsors. And the idea is to have a few sponsors, but the ones that we really, really like, and probably international too. So we're in that process right now.
And in terms of the design, I like it very much. And it does remind me of some encyclopedias I used to read when I was a kid in Brazil. You know, there's a nice old-fashioned typography as well, which I loved it, you know. And I guess it was kind of your inspiration as well.
Yeah, it was this kind of magazines from the 80s that were kind of a little bit clunky, but also, you know, kind of simple. And my top choice for that was asking Benjamin Creton. He's a designer from New York, and he agreed on doing it. And, you know, I just love his work, so I was really happy with, he's a typographer. So, you know, we have like 8 different typefaces. That's been a really good collaboration with him.
And that was Juan Ignacio Moralejo speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24, and now we're going to talk about a couple of the magazines that we've been hearing about, and a couple of others besides. Here with me now in the studio is Monocle's David Pleasant.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, David. How are you?
Very well. You know I love talking about magazines.
I know. You're,
I'm happy to be here.
I can only describe for listeners, you're beaming right now.
I am. Yeah, I'm really excited.
Now, we were just hearing about compost, and you've got a copy here. What have you made of this? Because it was interesting hearing some of the insights from Juan Ignacio there and from Fernando. What's your view? It's a handsome little object, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I have to say that it's rare that I get so excited about a magazine. We see a lot of really nice things. We're lucky to have the desks that we have, aren't we, Tom? Because
we
see wonderful magazines every day. But this landed on my desk, as we heard, from Buenos Aires. And I just thought it was such a treat. It's quite hard to describe in a way. I'll pass it to you. As we heard, it's a kind of compendium of life, from literature to music to art to dogs that we'll see in a little sec. So one of the stories is of Morrissey's letters that he used to write to British music magazines in his, I think, late teens. And they are just so funny. It's like so geeky. It's just incredible. and they're very plainly printed. You can really read them, and it's just sort of, it's really good. Like there's one here, like, Horses by Patti Smith has virtually no competition as the most exciting rock album of the year. He's just so kind of into music. It's so passionate. And then from that, you go to a story here about the Borzoi breed, the hound.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of dog magazines generally.
Exactly.
So if we get into sort of Borzoi detail,
Borzoi, it's just a beautiful shoot showing these elegant dogs. It must be in a kind of suburban Buenos Aires kind of, there's a lawn, it's something quite American about that kind of lawn.
Well, it's quite funny. It was interesting. Fernando mentioned in his little report there about almost an encyclopedia-like quality. And some of the pictures have that.
Exactly.
It looks like a reference book almost.
Or academic, because some of the, and there's something, the smell of it is that sort of kind of, I don't know what it is. You know those kind of 1970s pamphlets? And yeah. It's just sort of,
Feels like it belongs in a kind of dusty old library, in a most charming way.
Or I'm thinking sort of military era Argentina, sort of. There's something of that aesthetic, the print and everything. It's really, there's so much in there. I haven't got through it.
It's a handsome volume. Now, it's interesting if you were hearing from Juan Ignacio there about, you know, his inspirations. He'd worked, I think, either for or for a time with some of the Apartamento team, and you can see some of that kind of very, very relevant, very current, very polished sort of magazine heritage, if you like, in what he's created here.
There is that, but also I think there's a kind of uniqueness about it. It's like something I've not really ever seen before. And also, I'm a great believer in kind of showing the provenance of where a magazine is from. And It's bilingual. It's in Spanish and English, which I think is really important, because I think there's this sort of like centrifugal force where everything just becomes the same. And, you know, globalization has this horrible effect of just making everything really banal. But here you sort of sense it's from Buenos Aires. And as if to prove that point, the last story is about a good looking chap. But it's a photo essay of this guy who is a farmer, basically. And it's him with his horses, him with his sons, him topless. It's not that kind of magazine, but but he is. It's rather a nice shot here in the golden
evening.
Well,
again, it looks like a shoot from a different era. It's sort of sun washed. It looks like sort of thing from a sort of 1970s US glossy or something almost. Those
exactly.
Images.
It makes me want to go to Argentina. And yeah, I can't recommend it enough. Compost.
There you go. Well, that's about as unequivocal a thumbs up as we give things. So Compost is one to look out for. It's not just that, though, David, in your little... It's a sort of mini stack. What have you got? You've got a couple of sort of design and architectural titles.
I thought Compost has that sort of air of an academic journal in places. And I thought it might be quite interesting to look at a publication that comes from academia. It comes from the Bartlett School of Architecture, but you wouldn't think it. It's called Lobby, and it has a foiled masthead. It looks like many other of the independent breed that we see, but it's actually a semi-academic journal. There are essays in here. I wouldn't call it a proper academic journal, because proper academic journals, you know, they have essays that are, you know, 20,000 words long. This is architecture musings from Britain's most prestigious architecture school, but done in a really interesting way. And some of the stories, again, are really unusual. There's one story is called My Willy, and it's about the phallus, the penis, and how it affects architecture. A big issue.
but well, depending on your perspective, I suppose.
Exactly. So, you know, sexism ain't dead, says the author. Us men are doing a fine job of keeping it alive. So, you know, really interesting, thought-provoking little essays about architecture. You wouldn't expect that from an architecture school. Have a look. What do you think?
And very handsome as well in its sort of palette of
pastels.
Blue and pink pastels.
Yeah.
Very elegant. And no, it's just one of those magazines you're leafing through it. I wanted to read two or three of the things that I could see flicking by as you turned. Time is a little short, David, but perhaps mention one more just briefly. You've got, a bit of an old favourite there.
Exactly. As we were on the theme of architecture, I thought we'd look at the current issue of Domus, the classic Italian architecture. You know, it's a sort of like architecture Bible in a way. And I know you like football, Tom. I thought we'd gloat over this wonderful story. They really focus on projects. That's what's so good about Domus. It's amazing photos. And then the plan. So this is a football stadium, the new Herzog and de Meuron football stadium in Bordeaux. And it's amazing. This looks like a rendering, a computer. It's so perfect, but it's not. It's photography on an amazing scale with plans, cross sections, words, text in Italian and English. It's just like if you want an architecture magazine, you cannot.
Well, again,
Domus.
Just leaping through this feature that you mentioned. Yeah, I mean, I want to stop and pore over the detail on every page.
15 pages about one stadium. It's incredible. I recommend people get that and put that in their tote bag for the summer.
There you go. Pay heed to the advice of David Pleasant. David, thanks for joining us on The Stack. As always, that brings us to the end of today's bumper show. It's been busy. Thanks to Tyler Brule, who joined us a little earlier from San Moritz, and to all of our contributors today. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our studio manager, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome, info@monocle.com. You know the way this works by now. Don't forget to join us at the very same time next week. From this edition of The Stack, though, thanks very much for listening.